one might be surprised to discover that Anglicanism is flourishing in Waco, and even right here at Baylor University, despite both being bastions of all things Baptist. We even have a Baptist church, I won't say which one, that is known as Last Stop Baptist, because it's the last Baptist church people go to before becoming Anglicans. Gary Dorian joins us in this episode to discuss his new book, Anglican Identities, Logos Idealism, Imperial Whiteness, and Commonweal Ecumenism, which is published by Baylor University Press. You are listening to Currents in Religion, a podcast from Baylor University's Religion Department and from Baylor University Press. I'm Zen Hess. Thanks for listening. My guest today is Gary Dorian. He is a prolific and celebrated author. He's also the Reinhold Niebuhr Professor of Social Ethics at Union Theological Seminary and Professor of Religion at Columbia University. His new book, Anglican Identities, is out with Baylor Press this spring. And later this year, if all goes well and according to plan, his memoir will also be published with Baylor. So if you find his story intriguing, keep an eye out for that volume sometime this fall or early winter. Okay, here is the interview with Gary Dorian. Dr. Gary Dorian, thank you so much for joining us on Currents in Religion.
Zen, I'm delighted to be with you.
So, Gary, I mentioned in my introduction to you that you have a memoir forthcoming with Baylor Press this fall. But just for our listeners here, say a little bit about what drew you to Anglicanism in the first place.
Well, I grew up with a Catholic soul. I grew up poor and rural in the middle of Michigan, Bay County. My parents were youpers from the Upper
Peninsula. Okay, yeah, yeah.
Michigan. We weren't very religious, but when we would venture into town, the town is Midland, next to us there in Bay County, my parents noticed, wow, this is a strange child. He cannot be dragged past the Catholic Church, just insisted on going in. We, as a family, we went to Mass sometimes. And then I would hook a ride with the neighbors too, and they would go, big family of Sapanskis, and I would crawl in the back of their station wagon and go with them as well. So I do have this Catholic background of being especially struck by the crucifix overhanging the altar and just that sacred aura that exists in Catholic sanctuaries. It drew me, that the crucifix especially riveted me, like nothing else broke through to me. Like nothing else in my basically jock oriented Bay County world, and it was especially the, you know, just what kind of religion is this in which the God figure is suffering hideously on a cross? That this is the symbol. What does it even sort of say about God? About what kind of religion this is? When this is the symbol, the sheer strangeness of it and what's repelling about it, but also compelling. And it just caught me as just the truest, most riveting thing in the world. And it also gave me some sort of an ideal about, you know, whatever kind of religious meaning I'm trying to imagine or construe for myself in a fairly nominally Catholic family. So that certainly was the hook. And then years later, not that many years later, I'm only in the ninth grade when I'm reading about Martin Luther King, and then even reading his book on Stride Toward Freedom. King himself was a similarly riveting figure to me who just sort of broke through. Mm-hmm. And so then these once... later in my high school years, when King was assassinated, these two cross stories just sort of melded in my thought and feeling. That was pretty much all the religion I really had going to college, is that the impact of Catholic sacramentalism and the cross, the crucifix there, and then Martin Luther King, and how these things sort of come together and to form a religious worldview that's been, it's been my touchstone ever since.
Yeah.
There wasn't much more to it than that when I got to college, but I had read a lot about King, and also read a number of James Baldwin books. Mm-hmm. So I had ideas about all these theologians I wanted to read. Once I finally was in a place where I would walk into a library that had books by theologians, it just didn't exist before, right?
Right.
So I had had years in high school where I was a jock. I mean, I was a high profile jock in a sports factory of a school. So that's what my life is really about there. But I always had this sort of intellectual, spiritual thing on the side and boring into me. That I was on the path of when I went to college. And so it was a great thrill for me to walk into the library of Alma College and discover, indeed, they've just got rows and rows and rows of books by not just theologians, but also philosophers I never heard of. So that was sort of the hook for me. I mean, I am that person who...
Yeah.
Had all those experiences. I didn't actually join a church though until I was 29 years old.
Okay.
So it's not like, you know, it just took me right in. No, I've got to think about this for a long time.
Yeah.
And I was a solidarity organizer all through my 20s and early 1930s.
Okay.
I was a jock. I was an athlete through high school and college and long beyond.
And sorry, and then, you have to tell us what sports you were playing.
Oh, I was in high school, it was year round.
You're playing everything.
And for me, the issue there was, football and basketball, yes. And then the spring comes the crisis because my dad is an obsessed golfer. My relationship with my father is based on the fact that I'm out there, you know, I'm following him around the golf course.
Yeah.
Became a golfer. So I'm shooting in the 70s by the time I'm 16 years old. And this is now a conflict because really my best sport is baseball. So I went through quite a struggle over that early in high school before I finally settled on, you gotta stick with baseball.
Yeah.
And then did, you know, in college and beyond semi-pro leagues and so on. But yes, I took all that into college. I had a wonderful sort of college experience so far as things intellectual were concerned. And then I went off to graduate school and got degrees and so on. I always had it in my head that I've got to land somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, I was standing in an Episcopal pulpit at 31 years of age before I really find myself. No, I must have some theology because it's what I'm preaching here on the week. You know,
right.
Until then, you know, the academy just rewards you for being able to look at everything six different ways, and just to consume all the knowledge you can about, you know, various philosophies and theologies and the like. So I was in that mode for quite a while. And meanwhile, what my core commitment to is to social justice and to social solidarity organizing. So I did that all through my 20s. While also collecting degrees and fortunately married a Presbyterian pastor who told me, by the time I'm 29, really you're a bit overdue to finally join a church. Just don't join my church. There was a peculiarity about this. I was reading a great deal of William Temple at the time, and William Temple has been a lodestar figure to me ever since. And it is almost entirely on the strength of his work that I joined an Episcopal church, that plus this Catholic soul I've had all my life.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't find an Episcopal church that's anything like what William Temple is talking about.
Right.
Where we were in Albany, New York, where my wife had her job. And wow, these churches are nothing like what Temple is or is talking about. And indeed, my social justice friends, they can't understand. Why are you trying to join an Episcopal church? Just join one of these liberal Protestant churches. You went to liberal Protestant seminaries anyway. Just go to one of those, you know. And some of those churches were very active in our organizing, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's during the period of all of when the crisis in El Salvador and Nicaragua just blew sky high. Mm-hmm. And we're deeply involved in that. And I know all the folks in the Catholic diocese in Albany who do that kind of work. And they're all with me. Why are you trying to join some church that doesn't have anything to do with what we do?
Yeah.
And the only answer I had was, you know, well, I've got William Temple in my head. This is the guy, theologically, philosophically, this is the guy I identify with,
yeah.
regardless of this on-the-ground problem that I cannot find an Episcopal church that just smacks anything of what that was, until finally I did. I mean, I found mm-hmm. one that was kind of an oasis in that very conservative diocese, and they took me in, and they embraced all my intellectualism and social justice stuff and so on, and let me drag them into it. And I was ordained there. So I probably should not have been ordained based on how little experience I had of the Episcopal Church, which is none whatsoever,
yeah.
Before I joined a church in Albany, and they put me on a fast track. And the only reason it happened, I tell this a little bit of this story in the intro to Anglican Identities, and then a much more expansive version of it, obviously, in the memoir.
Yeah.
But I had a saintly bishop who just, the day he met me, liked me.
Yeah.
And he told me, you know, I don't have any clergy who can scrap with me about theology. Just, I don't know if they're incapable of doing it or they just won't do it with me. But mm-hmm. it's just frustrating to me. I can't, you know, this is someone who loved to talk shop about theology. He can't get anybody in his diocese to do it with him. Well, I'll do it.
Yeah.
So we bonded and we're friends, and I got the golden road to ordination in a diocese where it shouldn't have even been possible.
Right. Yeah.
So a couple of friendly rectors and one friendly bishop,
mm-hmm.
and of course it's not a very democratic church, so that was enough to sort of get me right to.
Yeah.
Where I need to go anyway.
and it is an interesting thing. These figures, the two friendly rectors and the bishop, were so formative. I mean, it comes out even just in part in Anglican Identities, but they're also the folks that you dedicated this book to. Is that right?
Yeah, I thought about all three of them a lot writing this book.
Yeah.
The one, Bruce Gray, was my rector. I have zero experience in Anglicanism before I walked into his congregation and said, oh, I think I could join this one.
Mm-hmm.
And Bruce was no intellectual. I mean, he had hardly any theologians on his shelves. He was comfortable when he was talking to firefighters.
Yeah.
But he welcomed me with open arms and mm-hmm. liked what I was able to do for that congregation and what I brought to it. And so just a wonderful, beautiful friend
mm-hmm.
That he was to me. And then I've already mentioned Bishop Hogg, Bishop Wilbur Hogg, who was his great theme was that we've got these two traditions of orthodoxy in Anglicanism, and it's tearing the communion apart that they're such rivals
mm-hmm.
and they need to find ways of sort of coming together. And that was his, you know, he had spent his whole career saying that kind of thing, which I later learned is it's a Michael Ramsey kind of argument. You know, from an Anglo-Catholic standpoint, saying need to find ways of making a deeper, stronger core
right.
Friendship with our own evangelical wing. And so based on that argument, he had been elected in Albany. But as I say, now he wants people to talk theology with him, and it turned out to be me, of all people. And then thirdly, the third figure there was Robert Purcell. And he was the guy they farmed me out to. And well, beyond that, he was the chair of the Commission on Ministry, thank goodness for me.
Mm-hmm.
And there I am sitting in the hallway waiting for my first meeting with the Commission on Ministry. More than a little nervous, knowing how just what a fish out of water I am
right.
In this whole diocese, and no, never went to an Episcopal seminary and so on. No, they're just going to blow me up. And he comes bounding out to the hallway and grabs my hands and shakes my hands and says, Gary, I'm so glad to meet you. Until this moment, I was the only intellectual in this diocese. And oh my goodness, before I've even started with this committee, I've got the chair on my side. And then, of course, he arranges it that he's going to be my tutor in things Anglican, because I need to be Anglicized.
Yeah.
Yes, I've got all these impressive degrees from places, but none of them have anything to do with Anglicanism. So, indeed, I met with him and marched right through what is now, you know, something like, you know, this my first time through, anyway, a kind of history of Anglican theology, and read what you need to read and pay attention to canonical figures and talk about who might be left out and what might be problematic, usual stories, and just even getting those, you know, the canonical stories on both sides and this broad church thing coming down in the middle, eventually all of that. Yeah, my first run through all of that stuff was with Father Purcell, who is a who was a pastor in Troy, because of course none of it, virtually none of it, had ever come up in the three places I studied previously,
right,
acquiring graduate degrees in theology.
So you're in your early 30s at this point. You've been ushered through the ordination process, and during that time, you'd identified some things that you didn't find compelling about the way that even these figures who you have deep respect for and who you esteem so greatly, the way that they were presenting Anglicanism to you seemed to some degree problematic. And it seems to me like that planted the seeds that have germinated over the past several decades of your life. And this book, in some sense, is identifying some of the issues that you recognized even there and tracing out ways of approaching them as an Anglican through the Anglican tradition. Does that seem right?
That's a very perceptive question. That's exactly right. I love Father Purcell and, of course, Bishop Hogg as well. With Father Purcell especially, he was a devotee of the Caroline Devine's argument.
We have
all this literature about what is Anglicanism, and it doesn't have an identity, or it's just got this halfway house identity that John Henry Newman for a time vigorously defended until he, you know, decided it was wrong and he threw it away, had to become a Catholic, and all these other Catholics end up following him to the Catholic Church. And Father Purcell was an adherent of this argument that whole mess of arguments is wrong because, in fact, Anglicanism does have an identity. People would just recognize it. It's that way of paying attention to reading the church fathers and praying like they did, and holding together a distinctly kind of English kind of Christianity that long predates the 16th century. It's people praying and conceiving a kind of moral meaning in the gospel that's distinctly sort of incarnational, that is not so concerned with hard and fast doctrines. If, you know, we don't need to fight about doctrines as long as, you know, we're praying together. And truly in a fellowship. And so there's some quite sort of lovely aspects of this argument. I don't totally reject it. What I resisted was the sense that this is yet another kind of kernel and husk essentialism, like others I've read before, because I'm a product of liberal. I went to Harvard and Union and Princeton, and I've read widely in modern theology outside of Anglicanism. So I recognize this kind of essentializing kind of thread in which you're trying to say, well, this is the real thing, and we don't really need to deal with all this other stuff out here. And that just always, every time I encountered it in my past, long before I was sitting in Father Purcell's study, I just felt like, no, this just feels like essentialist whitewash to me. There's just something here for all the parts of it that can be illuminating. Because certainly the Adolf van Harnack argument about kernel and husk that I just referred to, that's the whole Richelieu school, you know, it produced tremendous scholarship.
Yeah.
And the other version I was thinking of at the time was John Cobb's version of how to do interfaith dialogue. And John, in one of his early books before he gave this up, you know, thought about religions as themselves kind of they all have a kind of structural essence that can be compared one religion to another. Mm-hmm. And of course, back then when John wrote that book, you know, Christianity still wins, but it's nonetheless, it's a way of getting religions in conversation. And in both cases and in others that I was thinking of, I thought there can be something helpful about this. You feel like you've got your handle, it's got some handles for understanding religious traditions that are otherwise amorphous and, you know, many-sided and layered. And it's just, you know, you got the problem of, you know, the elephant and putting and the blind people with their hands describing which part, you know, they've got hold of.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, no, I am a social justice organizer. I cannot join this church and certainly can't become a cleric in it if I don't deal with the blood on the hands
right.
of this church about the evil that it has done in the world. I cannot. And now, yes, in the midst of even having these thoughts, and now a little back and forth with Father Purcell, that's a little bit contentious because some of these books he's wanting me to read, you know, none of the stuff that I know is true about the Church of England,
right?
About that is its role in world history and in
yeah.
and slavery and imperialism and all that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it didn't happen.
Right.
Like no recognition at all that that England getting into the slave trade is a crisis for the Church of England.
Right.
No, boy, just the barest pass at that kind of thing. And now we're back, you know, right back to a story that's going to take you to Newman and all those people. And I just always resisted that. I just thought and firstly, it's existential because I'm still not even sure I can go through with it.
Mm-hmm.
And whether I'm going to go through with seeking an ordination in this church, because my only real experience of this church is reading Temple and now one congregation, St. Andrew's Church in Albany. And maybe my friends are right that I've,
sure.
you know, I should really hang out with a group that's way more, that's closer to my experience, my commitments, you know, and the rest.
Yeah.
So that was all at stake for me with Father Purcell. But he blessedly, you know, he hung with me. It's not yeah. like, I disappointed him, but, he didn't say, oh goodness, I'm not going to support you
yeah.
on your way. And in fact, you know, I did make it in record time and they cut more than a few corners for me
yeah.
and some of them have been showing up ever since.
There you go. You know? There you go.
You are listening to Currents in Religion, and I'm speaking with Gary Dorian, author of the new Baylor University Press book, Anglican Identities. So tell us a little bit more about this particular book. You've given us a good framework for some of the things that were most stimulating to you as you were going through the ordination process intellectually, questions, existential questions and intellectual questions that you had. What, as you say, you've written this book in the twilight of your career, and as you've gotten to that point, what does this book do?
Yeah. Well, for many years, there was one section of my library that just kept growing.
Mm-hmm.
And all the other sections, you know, I would pare them back because I've written, I don't know, I've got 25 or so books out there. So I've written on all manner of things except my own confessional tradition. It's the one thing I've never written about
right.
per se. I mean, you know, it comes up in various connections and books here and there as I'm writing about modern theology
or
whatever. But I've never just written just straight out that just while well, here, Anglicanism is the subject. No, I've never done that. So, but I've always had it in mind. Yeah, there's going to have to be at some point, sooner or later, I'm going to write some massive two-volume thing that takes the whole story from the beginning in the 16th century, which, of course, isn't the beginning. So I'm going to have a half-chapter backup just to do a kind of quickie run-through about what English Christianity was before Cranmer and Henry VIII and all that. So there's going to be some first volume that takes me to some point. I always figured probably get up to the 1970s or so, because I do know what the break has to be. The break has to be, we've just moved over the edge into the church trying at least to become a post-colonial and decolonizing entity.
Right.
And that's got to be another whole trajectory, which is the Anglican Communion of my time, the time I've been in all this. So that's the earlier book, is taking readers through that whole early story. And I've always meant to do that. Mm-hmm. Whereas with other books, you know, you finish the book and you say, all right, okay, I don't need those things anymore.
Yeah.
That section piled up, but now I can winnow down. But boy, that Anglican section, oh my goodness, it's sprawling across the shelves and down the hallway and finally storage, putting with boxes with A on it. And that was just how it went for year after year, with this my storage, because I just kept reading in this field, and then, you know, put those books away for a later day. The later day came when the Episcopal Divinity School was looking to partner up with somebody, and the finalists got down to Harvard, Yale, and Union. And Serene Jones and I and Mary Boyce, Serene is our president, Mary our dean, we pitched EDS hard to come to Union, and they did. So for 6 years, we had EDS at Union, Episcopal Divinity School at Union. So we literally have an Episcopal seminary here, which immediately, well, not quite immediately, but as soon as we named Kelly Brown Douglas as our dean, Kelly comes to me, you know, and says, are you willing? Well, I've been gearing up for this anyway. Indeed, of course I'm willing to teach the course on Anglican, kind of a historical introduction to Anglican theology. So I did it three times, had to unbox all those books with A on them and buy new shelves and just line it all up, and had a wonderful time teaching that course here at Union. So that's the backstory to the book itself. By the third time that I'm teaching it, I've got a manuscript that's pretty close to being whipped into shape about it.
Yeah.
So it's that context helps to shape the kind of book that it is.
Yeah.
I've got people sitting there who grew up in Anglicanism. They've got pictures of Cranmer in the hallway, and they tell stories about this kind of thing, about just what it's like to have grown up in this communion and know all this inside scuttlebutt and so on, know all the canonical names and so on. So I've always got to be able to do it in a way that is giving them an angle on it that's not quite what they grew up with.
Yeah.
That's bringing in, you know, some of my questions about this, which have to do not just with the social justice and imperialism and all that, but also just the fact that, yes, I'm someone who's written all these other books on theological trends and the like that are in my head, that I just don't read Anglicanism as just something so insular and homeostatic that it's just something, you know, by itself, which does describe an awful lot of the literature in this field. And I know that it's what most of our students who are sort of raised in it, that's what they've experienced. So I'm bringing the entire modern theology discussion into it all the time.
Yeah.
I'm able to say, oh, yeah, meanwhile, this is what was going on over here, or over there. And that kind of thing gets into the text for them especially. But then I also know I've got a larger group who are kind of newcomers to this. They just fairly recently joined an Anglican church, or they're considering it. And that's the group that I've especially got in mind.
Yeah.
Got to lay it out in a way that that kind of takes people by the hand and says, this is not, it's not too complicated. It is complicated, but not impossibly so. And it does make sense also how it evolved the way that it did. So I've got, that's my primary group that I've got in mind, people who know they're interested and are just getting into it and have got questions just by virtue of living in our time. And then there is this, you know, the others, people who are going through a regular seminary curriculum and going through other aspects, other fields, as in your field, New Testament, but have got some interest for one reason or another in, what did go on in Anglicanism.
Right.
So I've always got a few of those folks as well. And I've got them very much in mind writing this book because the book itself is a product of teaching this very course.
Right.
That's how it came along. So, yes, the title is Anglican Identities, Logos Idealism, Imperial Whiteness, Commonweal Ecumenism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tell us about those. What's the subtitle all about?
It's pretty well summarized there. Firstly, there is the emphasis on Logos Idealism, which firstly goes to just the emphasis, the centrality of the incarnation in Anglican tradition and theology. And I am making argument about that. Yes, indeed, that claim that there's some distinct sort of emphasis on the incarnation in Anglican forms of Christianity, even in highly Protestant or evangelical forms of Anglicanism, still will have this in a way that's partly a function of just this prayer book that we inherit and the way that it lays out. And something underneath that I do go pretty hard for, which is just the, this is a tradition which isn't afraid of the notion that no theology is stronger than whatever philosophy it's sitting on, that there's some philosophical undergirding underneath every theology under the sun. And so there's just sort of a question as to what is it? What's the mix and match of philosophical influences that goes into this particular theological construction? How self-conscious of its philosophizing is it? What is its relationship to that whole history of arguments about firstly Neoplatonism and then Neo-Aristotelianism and all that? And yes, this is a tradition that doesn't run from early Christian Neoplatonism, or then as it moves into a more Neo-Aristotelian or kind of logical realist kind of mishmash of Platonism and Aristotelianism, or Thomas Aquinas, or if we name only one more figure in this line in Anglicanism, it's Hegel, right?
Yeah, so, there you go.
I am making an argument about that. Of course, this is part of what drew me in, because this is so William Temple.
Mm-hmm.
That this is a tradition that is comfortable with, has a kind of easy spiritual, intellectual familiarity with, no need to kind of overthrow the philosophy part, such that it is more like Roman Catholicism and just assuming, of course, there's some philosophical undergirding that informs the Protestantism, where you're looking at just, cut that stuff out,
right,
and just run on some interpretation of a sola scriptura authority. So that's the whole, how that plays out, Logos Idealism, including its thinning out during the late 17th century and especially the 18th century, as it thins out in more and more kind of thinner kind of British empiricism. So that a figure like Samuel Taylor Coleridge, within the Anglican story — Coleridge is a fabulous figure in many other respects, but within an Anglican story, as I emphasize, this is the person who brought post-Kantian idealism into England,
right,
and for who recovers in a kind of full-throated way the whole heritage of Logos idealism in English Christianity that was in danger of being lost by virtue of being thinned out by this very thin kind of British empiricism, John Locke and all that.
Right.
Where you just even lose what the Logos even sort of meant in earlier traditions of Anglican thought. So I run with that. And you know, this is partly a function, as I, you know, admitted there that, you know, this is where I came in with William Temple and his Neo-Hegelian way of interpreting the whole tradition. This was always very attractive to me, and it is something that I love in Anglicanism. And then we get to imperial whiteness, and yes, it's all that stuff.
Right.
All the just the sheer carnage, the contribution of the Church of England to the racist sickness of Western civilization itself, including a story that just needs to be told because England was a little bit of a latecomer to the slave trade. And Queen Elizabeth herself was on record, you know, saying that, oh, the heavens would shake and just thunder against us if we ever got into this vile business.
Yeah.
And then Francis Drake comes back to England, shows her the immense riches that can be wrought from the slave trade. Mm-hmm. And the next thing you know, the Queen of England not only was wanting to tolerate it, she wants in on it.
Right.
And so the whole, all of that sort of comes from England being something of a latecomer to it, now in a race to catch up, and not only catch up, but race ahead of everyone else, becoming the I almost said greatest, you know, the large,
sure,
most powerful slave trading concern in the world. All the while, I do continue to play this sort of moral ethical trickle line here, that, you know, it's not like they didn't know it was evil.
Right.
I mean, one sign of it is that they didn't allow it in England themselves.
Right.
Itself.
Right.
This is okay for out there, but you can't have it here. And once that's finally certified in court in the 1770s, that's when you start to get an abolitionist movement in England.
Because
if it actually looks like maybe the courts are on our side if you're an abolitionist, plus, you know, England lost the colonies, so it was a moment to strike. And so that's where you get an abolitionist movement. Then you get this strange phenomenon, which itself, it's its own distinct, strange thing of kind of 19th century Church of England that now thinks of itself as this abolitionist force, right? Mm-hmm. Now we've turned against it. Meanwhile, we're building the greatest empire ever seen on earth. So you've got this simultaneous development of this incredibly expansive empire that thinks that prides itself on being the tutor to the world, and can say with some legitimacy, and there's something to it to say, but we've turned against slavery. We're now, we're now abolitionists, or at least slavery.
And you
so all the complexity that goes with that, including what it's tied to theologically. Mm-hmm. I agree with Willie Jennings about this, my dear colleague at Yale, about how we can't talk about modern Christianity without just talking about the colossal catastrophe that occurred with the transatlantic slave trade and what it did to the to Christian souls and to the various civilizations we created. But then going from that, commonweal ecumenism is the other thing, Anglicanism has been in the ecumenism business virtually from the beginning. I mean, it starts with something just as prosaic as, not quite Roman Catholic and not quite certainly sola scriptura or Protestant either. Of course, there's a big bruising argument about how Protestant are we.
Mm-hmm.
It just sort of drives the story through the late 16th and all through the 17th century. Goodness, they had a civil war over it. So that is a very big thing. And here I am quite concerned to spell out in some detail how this side, this group that came to be called Puritans, they are just good Anglicans who believe, before Anglicanism is really a name even, they're just saying, we haven't gone far enough. We're not as Protestant as we should be in this Church of England.
Mm-hmm.
We should be more Presbyterian than we are.
Yeah.
That's all that really is about. But of course, it bodes large. It has ripple effects that are tremendous. But the fact that even that, just that argument is so at the center of this thing that isn't even, doesn't really, shouldn't be even called Anglicanism yet, but is developing into it. Mm-hmm. There's a concern with ecumenical dialogue, with ecumenical understanding, and of simply being, developing a church. And of course, Anglicanism is the type of Christianity where theology is always about ecclesiology. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are certainly other Protestant traditions where you could, you know, ecclesiology is just like the caboose,
right,
or something very low order, right?
Yeah.
Ecclesiology, what's that? Here I wear the Reinhold Niebuhr name around my neck. Reinhold Niebuhr had a very, very low view of the church.
Right.
It's just a group like any other, right? Anglicanism is a theological tradition where there's just no theologizing that isn't actually always coming out of and being about ecclesiology. And that is always ecumenical, with an ecumenical impulse and aspiration that I think is one of its better traits. And that, for that, you go all the way back to the beginning. I mean, that's not just Cranmer, but then especially Hooker.
Yeah.
So that is these are threads that are all these three subtitle headings. Mm-hmm. They're in the entire book. They're threads that run throughout the whole.
And clearly, all of this is so dear to your heart. But I've been kind of curious. You mentioned how you had for a long time had to pack books away, and then you finally got to unbox them, shelve them, go through them with students in classrooms. You've written this book now. I'm just curious, throughout that process, if there was some part of this research that you've done for this book and for teaching this class that you found most exciting or energizing, or perhaps, I don't know, maybe something that as you were reading, you were surprised to discover about this tradition that you've been a part of for so long.
Oh, thank you. Oh, that's such a friendly question. Thank you. I think just two things. And the first thing I need to hardly say anything further about, because I've already said it. To have the occasion to just line up William Temple on the shelf again and just read all of these books from the first one to the last.
Yeah,
I was just like a kid in a sandbox. It's like, this is what I'm supposed to do now. Yeah. It's just reread William Temple. So it was just the most wonderful experience. I loved it. I didn't want it to end. But then secondly, another figure, now we're getting to the end of the book.
Yeah.
And that's Desmond Tutu. Mm. And of course, Tutu is marking something. There's a bit of a transition to what's going to be a second volume sort of later on. And of course, I knew a great deal about Desmond Tutu. He's a prime kind of figure in my life, of someone you look to. And I was deeply involved in the anti-apartheid movement in this country in the late 1980s and early 90s. So, you know, he is just a lodestar figure as well in my life.
Yeah.
Someone you look to. But that's a mostly political story. I mean, mostly how it played out in the world at that time is, you know, arguments about apartheid in South Africa and the government and enfranchising the vast majority and so on. And so to be able to revisit all of that again, but now much more in Tutu's own Anglican sort of context. And even realizing, as I hadn't really fully before, how he is a bit late to even be kind of pulled into a political struggle, because he's got an Anglo-Catholic background, and he gets to England and gets graduate degrees and is kind of on his way, and yet still doesn't really have a political bone in his body. He's got that Christian conscience that sort of ends up pulling him into this work once there's a movement that is raising that issue. But he wasn't someone who just, you know, grew up saying, I'm going to be, you know, a social justice warrior or anything like that. Far from it. And yet once he did get pulled into it, there he is. And this is the other part of it I hadn't quite seen before. I just hadn't realized that Desmond Tutu was, in the early 1970s, is a player in the argument between an emerging Black theology tradition that's mostly around John Mbiti, explicating what that is. It's an Afrocentric theology and worldview that he's and And then what becomes Black theology in this country, in the USA, principally James Cone, and Desmond was reading both of these figures and feeling that, yes, two sides of his own being are being described in these two discursive traditions. Mm. And I hadn't known, he came to a conference here at Union in 1972, which was about this very thing, about, you know, how do African theology and Black liberation theology even come together? What do they have in common? What do they not have in common, and so on? Now, the way that played out, I mean, John Mbete was at that conference, and he taught with Jim Cone here at Union for a year. And yet it was only after he went home that then he came out with this very famous, you know, statement, I mean, article about what they have in common. And he said the answer was almost nothing, right? Almost nothing. And it was very hurtful to Jim. Yeah. To read. Jim had no idea that this was coming. But there's Desmond Tutu right in the middle of this now back and forth between those two, because he knows Mbete, for all the things that Mbete got right, Mbete can't be right about this, because Desmond feels it in his own being, how these are two discourses that actually belong together, because otherwise he's just going to split apart.
Yeah.
And now I got to run all of that through his Anglo-Catholic Anglicanism, that's just mother's milk to Desmond, because, you know, he was raised in that and is very much a product of it. So so the book sort of ends with him and all of that.
Yeah.
And I, that too, I was almost sad when I realized, okay, I need to just write it up. I've read everything now, and there's no more to read about this.
Yeah.
It was also a lovely thing there. You know, Kelly Douglas is one of my dearest friends, and she was very close to Desmond Tutu. In fact, named her son after him, and Desmond Tutu did the baptism of her son. So just being able to know talk shop with her as that section was coming along, there's nothing quite like that.
Wow. And so this is where the book ends, this book. You do have a second volume that I think you're angling at doing to extend some of that out, the kind of post-colonial impulses within Anglicanism. I've got this kind of last question. You can feel free to run further down that road if you'd like, or if you'd like to address a different issue, I would welcome that too. You know, the Anglican Communion has lots of uncertainty facing it today. There's all sorts of question marks about its ability to remain a communion, or maybe even just a definition of what what communion means. And there are a number of pressing issues. How has your study of Anglican history shaped or changed the way that you think about the challenges that are facing the Anglican Communion today?
Yeah, thanks. You know, firstly, Anglicanism has a long, long, long history of muddling through.
Yeah.
this is the communion that was just never one thing.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
So you have just really fundamental differences, that aren't actually settled, that just ended up producing this party system.
Mm-hmm.
And then that just became this so-called communion is just habituated to its own parties. And so the whole thing about, you know, high church or low church, which later you get language about what comes to be called Anglo-Catholic versus evangelical.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got people coming along and say, oh, this is terrible that we fight all the time over these things. So you have a transcendent figure like Frederick Denison Morris, who has an argument against this very thing within Anglicanism, wanting to make there is a kind of comprehensive something that pulls us all together. But no, that just becomes another option itself. You know, that sort of way of thinking about it. And it's not the broad church, because he's quite insistent. No, I'm not some broad church liberal. Don't call me that. During the very time when that tendency is also acquiring a name and history and becoming a party. So you've got that kind of four-sided contention going on coming out of the 19th century. And it's just, you know, that's never not going to be. Yeah, at least that much all along. And then, of course, yes, so much more. Once this is not just a story about, you know, a home church with imperial outposts, but it's indeed truly a global church that takes root in cultures and becomes something else wherever it is, and then takes selectively from its own history, including ecumenical versions, say in India, where the Anglican strain, the Anglican strand of a church identity is still important. It's there, and yet it's not called Anglicanism per se. And, you know, it's some other kind of confessional tradition with a name that's more inclusive than simply the Anglican strand.
Right.
So yeah, with all that kind of bewildering diversity, I think there's just the sheer ability, capacity of the Anglican communion always to be able to keep sustaining itself by, you know, keeping your head down and mumbling morning prayer and hanging together and being held together by that book, whatever it is in your context. And of course, we got quite a very rather different kinds of books out there at this point around the world. And yet people are drawn to this communion and held by it for reasons that actually are, you can recognize as familiar if you know about the 17th century or the 18th or the 19th, right? People say quite similar things about what they're drawn to, the Catholic sensibility and the intellectual freedom and all the rest of it. Just even the clash of the parties. There's something like, okay, since it's so in the DNA that we're never gonna have one group that just wins. Yeah. You're somewhat, when you grow up Anglican, you're just, I think, not that I would know, but you're kind of inoculated into this, you know, this view that, oh, there's just one way of hearing the gospel. Well, clearly there isn't, not even within your own tradition. There is. So it does somewhat inoculate you against that idea that, oh, you just have to find the one that's true and then just fight over it, right?
Yeah.
So that to me is, that's every bit as much, you know, consoling and something there's a hopefulness in that. That isn't just that usual, oh my God, how can this group hold together?
Yeah.
And of course, you know, for a while there, they kicked us out of Lambeth. We couldn't even go for a while there because they were so mad at us. And that kind of thing is going to continue to happen.
Yeah.
You know, churches are going to have that kind of struggle is going to just continue if not multiply. I would say it's kind of second nature for me, having gone to liberal Protestant seminaries, to think, you know, when I came into it, I kind of, that broad church tradition, of course, that's my group.
Yeah.
And I have a tendency to think of it as, that's the group that's holding together these other wings, right? Mm-hmm. I'll confess it. Yeah, that's my basic proclivity.
Yeah,
is to think of it this way. Certainly, that was my experience. That's what even seems most like it makes most sense to me intellectually, and that's certainly what plenty of broad church people said about themselves and about their own tradition. Yet I have to say, and it comes through in this book, and it will come through even more in the next one. That wow, this Anglican versus evangelical thing has not, it's just as hot as it ever was.
Yeah.
it just every bit as contentious and out there, up there, as it ever was. Now, one dynamic that did change, and I've now in my book, you know, I mean this starts with the late 1940s. I mean, you know, the evangelicals were a group that were kind of left out historically. I mean, you know, Anglo-Catholics at Oxford and liberals at Cambridge and evangelicals just had millions of evangelicals out there, right? That aren't represented by these, you know, these great prestigious universities. And of course, England is a place that has remarkably few universities anyway, especially if you're, you know, you basically think German most of the time, the way I do, and you're thinking about all these German universities. You transpose to a British context and wow, the university system is just nothing compared to what that was. So there's not many alternatives despite all the work that the Puritans did and try to build these academies that, you know, like you know, built some infrastructure that passes down Protestantism. They were certainly very industrious. And so for the lack of kind of prestigious university infrastructure that the evangelicals had to deal with right up to the heyday of C.S. Lewis, you know, they're just kind of hanging in there. And the contention between those two parties is such a thing. Well, then the whole institutional structure does change. When you get evangelicals making real headway into Oxford and Cambridge.
Right.
And partly, of course, this starts with C.S. Lewis and then John R. Stott and the whole development of what University Christian Fellowship became. And later on, Don Coggan and others, evangelical bishops. So, I mean, the evangelicals had no bishops for so long.
Right.
And now you have evangelical bishops in Anglicanism. So that the kind of playing out of that this is something that I had to see more on its own terms finishing this book.
Yeah.
Because I can see it coming in a way that then is familiar to me today, because I know what's going on today.
Right.
And I've lived with it in my own time, but I can see that really from about the 50s onward, you're getting a kind of parity between what are, in fact, the stronger parties, even if I am predisposed to think of them as the wings of the Anglican Communion. No, these are the two dominant parties, in fact. And they interact with each other far more than they sort of deal with these liberals in the middle who think they're holding it together. So that's a thing. And then far beyond that, of course, there will have to be the next volume will be harder to pull together because you've got such vastly different cultural, geographic contexts and the like to deal with. Just dealing with India and South Africa and Canada and the U.S. and New Zealand, and places where they're just strong, you know, Anglican communions of very different sort of kinds, it will have to start with Dalit theology. I kind of signaled that in the book. I've already got the African, South Africa, especially South African story mobilized already. That's gone on from volume one. But once I get rolling in volume two, I do think I'll start with Dalit, the Dalit movement in Indian Anglicanism. Okay. That's starting up just at the time where my volume one is running out. Okay. I don't, partly because of my historical bent and just seeing that it's been like this for so long, I'm not someone who kind of, you know, nervous Nelly about it, kind of thing, oh goodness, this will never work. I'm actually more hopeful than not about this communion. People find their way. Anglicanism is not good at raising its own. There aren't that many people who kind of grow up in it and then embrace it and then keep it going. I mean, I love it whenever I come across them here at Union or out there on the road. But, you know, this has long been a communion that really got its lifeblood from just in getting people crossing over from an evangelical Protestant world and from Roman Catholicism. And that's still the case.
Yeah. Keep muddling through and praying morning prayer, yeah?
Yeah, that's so.
Dr. Dorian, thank you so much for taking time to chat with us on Currents in Religion.
Zen, I'm so grateful for this opportunity and the chance to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Hey again. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Currents in Religion. If you enjoyed it, I hope you'll share it with someone that you think might like it too. You can also subscribe so you don't miss future episodes, and you could leave us a review, which would let us know how we're doing, and it would also help other people find us a little bit easier. All right, well, we have another episode coming out next week, but until then, take care.